Yoga Vashishta, Part 7 by Swami Suryadevananda. Prayer before study. Salutations to that reality in which all the elements and all the animate and inanimate beings shine as if they have an independent existence, and in which they exist for a time and into which they merge. Salutations to that consciousness which is the source of the apparently distinct threefold divisions of knower, knowledge and known, seer, sight and seen, doer, doing and deed. Salutations to that bliss absolute, the ocean of bliss, which is the life of all beings whose happiness and unfoldment is derived from the shower of spray from that ocean of bliss. This is what we talked about the last time. Beyond conditioning. When inner vigilance is empowered, one can stay free of conceptualization, remaining steady and unagitated as the intelligence is fully awakened. This is the way to bring the habitual mind under control. 2. Purification. Purification is fixing the attention on the sense of self in the awakened state. The practice of fixing your attention within, in the space of your heart, helps weaken the habitual mind. When concepts do not arise, the mind vanishes. The non-arising of these concepts purifies the mind. 3. Staying undistracted. In the non-arising of concepts lies perfection. Vashishtha says, you are conquered by the mind when a concept arises in it and illumines the diverse objects. The second part is perhaps the most important, and illumines. Let concepts arise, but why should they illumine the object if we are awake and we can engage it directly? He further says, you will conquer the mind if you rest in the sense of self, undistracted by the concepts. So let the concepts be there. The key is not to get distracted by them. The key is not to let them illumine the objects. And the last point was beyond restlessness. Eternal vigilance drains the mind of objectivity, and it begins to melt into subjectivity. It is the power of restlessness of the mind that creates the world illusion. Our topics today include restlessness, and we'll look at it in a practical way that restlessness itself is ignorance, controlling the mind, understanding renunciation, and renunciation. Greetings. Before we begin today, a couple thoughts. If we stay purely with the way the Yoga Vashishta is written and the way of the scripture, it would be hard to find its practical means. Remember, this scripture was a conversation or a dialogue between Rama, the perfect seeker, and the great sage Vashishta, the sage of cosmic consciousness. Rama had taken steps that is difficult to take for the average seeker. He was a prince by nature, among many other things. And a level of renunciation had arisen in him naturally, where he had walked away from everything, the palace and everything else, for one entire year. And in that year, returned with a state of inner renunciation of Vairagya, with an awakened sense of wisdom that is very difficult for most people to attain casually, just by reading. So if we try to look at it in the context of how it was, without bringing it down a few notches, and looking at it practically, it may be a bold step, but difficult to put into practice. So throughout this series, I have chosen to put in things that will bring the message down and make it a little bit more tenable and practicable. With that, let's begin on the first topic, which is renunciation. The mind has three modes of operation. Sattva, which is natural balance, purity, all of those things, wholesomeness. Rajas, which is dynamism, activity, movement, and it also includes restlessness. And the last of all is tamas, which includes dullness, lethargy, and things of that kind. Restlessness of the mind is rajasic, and it is mental conditioning and operation. Why would the mind be restless? There has to be some movement of energy in it. But it's not just movement of energy. When this energy moves over notions and ideas that we have, over our likes, over our dislikes, over our preferences, and that is contrasted with reality or that which appears in front of you, there is a sort of inner restlessness and inner grinding. And that is rajas. It takes many shapes and many forms. It can take passion, it can take attachment, it can take rejection, it can take all of those. But it has to start with the mind inside, not at rest. And that's why it's called restlessness. The more conditioning acts in our life, the more restlessness gets infused with new energy. So it becomes important to find a way to first keep this existing restlessness from acting, and two, take on or not take on any new forms of restlessness. Why? Because as we've covered earlier, mental actions are real actions, and that's what triggers the wheel of karma into action. So taking the gist of Vasishtha's teachings, I would like to blend in a few things on a practical dimension that make these things things that can be practiced and not just concepts that we can hear about and then go by on our life differently, because it's a tall order to practice some of these teachings. So let us look at it in a very simple way on three separate little areas on which we could practice this one thing to cut down restlessness. Number one, simple living. This is the key to it all. Swami Sivananda recommends a threefold approach to spiritual practice. Number one, having a clear-cut goal of life. He calls an ideal of life or a goal of life. Yes, there are small goals. We want to be successful. We want to go do. But why do we do things anyway? What is the finally, as we would say? A plan to accomplish them and a system of self-accountability to make sure that we stay on track. An intelligent system of self-accountability. This allows us to do what needs to be done and to accomplish them. These are the ways to cut out restlessness. Restlessness grows in an unchecked area. It grows because it isn't checked. It isn't seen. It's a hidden, like the hidden weed that grows in the garden and tries to take over the entire patch. And it starts off in the form of whims and fancies. If there is an eye to keep this mind observed at all time, and at the same time, a practical way to engage life, as we said, with these three, a clear-cut ideal of life or a goal of life. And this can be anything from perfection, wanting to know the self, ethical and moral improvement, etc. Something very lofty that transcends all the changing that can be applied to all the departments of our life, whether it be family, whether it be work, whether it be whatever. There has to be common principles that can be applied to every aspect of our life. Something that's broad and uplifting that will work on the sense of self. And this is what we mean by a clear-cut goal of life. Something big, to know myself, to know my true nature. Then there has to be an intelligent plan to accomplish this. How am I going to chart out my activities, and what are the things that I am going to stay away from that are counterproductive? And last of all, a system of accountability, an intelligent system of accountability that makes sure that I stay on track. Why is it simple living? It's simple because it streamlines our effort towards that which is best that we have decided for ourselves. And that's what makes life simple. Unchecked life is complex because we have to deal with whims and fancies and moods and conditioning as it arises while we are dealing with life in itself. That is complex. Friends, when you do what is best for you, the best returns as a result. Now let's move on to a second practical dimension in decreasing restlessness. Continual vigilance. For this, we've got to get rid of that word multiple tasking. Do one thing at one time and do it with all of your being, as if that were the last thing that you would do, period. And not because of some purpose beyond it, but because it needs to be done. The purpose should not be beyond the activity. When the purpose is beyond the activity, there will not be wholeheartedness and effort. When you put the purpose in the activity because it needs to be done, not for something, there's no reason for the mind to go to that for something. It stops right here. The buck stops right here. And the entire effort is focused on the activity. The sense of self and activity merge into one melt. So you stand together with things by doing what needs to be done because you don't put anything beyond it. There is no my interest or what comes or what I expect, and therefore a high or a low or a letdown or any of those things. So along with this, this sense of my weakens, because when you take out what's best in my interest, what's in it for me, that sense of my, when it's not tied into action, into engaging life, weakens that sense of my tremendously. Because it needs to be done, because I can do it, that's it. Let the chips fall where they may. This weakens the whole sense of personality, which is a front end of the ego, while strengthening vigilance. Now a simple third practical dimension. Balanced practice. In our practice, we must not be lopsided. Swami Sivananda calls this the yoga of little. Basically, doing a little bit of different things, which keeps your interest level very high and keeps you from specializing. Specializing is a work of the ego, and that is kept in check. This has many more practical uses too. When the mind is turbulent, you can take to another practice that doesn't involve the mind, like asanas and pranayama and things of that nature. And you can keep your practice from becoming mechanical, and it gives you a wider base. When this restless mind is made quiet, and it is made quiet by renunciation, to renounce, you have to weaken the mind first. It is difficult, possible, but very difficult to renounce a strong mind, strong sense of conditioning. And it is then that the goal becomes easier. So practice on life, in life, and practice on the mat must be seamless. You cannot live in a haphazard manner and have a strong practice because it's not going to take seed. The mind will swing from how it was, the way you live, and how you are expecting it to be in your practice. Practice is a way of melting the mind where what you do is not in the act of doing, but an extension of being of who you are. So by relentless vigilance, one's understanding is purified. And this is inner renunciation, when by watching the mind, you first give up all of the concepts, you're willing to give up all of the conditioning, all of the isms, all of that interference. Are we willing to give that up first and start at that base? Give up our ignorance, give up our conditioning, give up our restlessness. When this restlessness is curbed, the mind attains its sense of quiet. Now we come to the second point, which is controlling the mind. Giving the mind a positive direction or field to work in is a practical and struggle-free method of controlling the mind. We have just talked about having a clear ideal of life, what we want to accomplish. And it is not having that that creates a problem on this side in controlling the mind. So when we have a clear direction of travel, there is little room to meander around. And the mind needs this positive direction. What is it that underlies all action? Not, I do, this is my philosophy at work, and this is my philosophy or important field at home, etc. down the line. These are competing principles. One thing, a positive direction that threads all the different fields or areas or aspects in which we engage life, like family, work, etc. So having a clear-cut ideal is very important. What is it that is worth striving for that threads all these different situations? It is that that is going to bring order and peace and stability in the mind. So this will throw light on all situations with what we consider best. And what we consider best or what we are trying to accomplish will become the common denominating factor in all the aspects of our life. So when something happens very different, it's not going to rock the boat or shake the boat, as it were. Struggle and its resulting pressures are the result of conflicting priorities. So we're going back actually to what we have spoken about, and that is having a clear-cut priority as a way to reduce the clutter and noise of the mind. This clutter and noise of the mind is competing priorities at work. When we're at work and we have thoughts of family or thoughts of something else, that comes in. But if, whether we're at work or whether we're at home or wherever it be, if there is one focus to purify my mind so my true self can be seen, or mastery of self, or self-improvement, then in each department or in each area or compartment of our life, we're going to be doing our very best. That's all that we can do, finally, our very best. In every situation, the mind finds peace and quiescence in that. So one single purpose, it can be moral perfection, it can be ethical perfection, or it can be to see your true nature or know yourself. It can be any of those, but it has to be something as big and wide as that, that stretches across all the fields of activity in which we find ourselves engaged in. So having this clearly established in our heart, the mind will be watched relentlessly, because you're clearly telling it what you are trying to accomplish. The mind will watch itself, will police itself thoroughly. And all the inner promptings will be seen along with the situation, considered by the inner intelligence, and the best course of action will be charted out and embarked upon. The force of habit, my friends, will be greatly weakened when we have this overlying principle. Mostly, we have small principles, and not just to the areas or aspects of our life compete, but the principles that we establish for our own selves compete with the other principles. So there has to be some common ground that threads everything. It is this that is going to bring order. And it is then that we'll do what is best, and it'll become natural to us. And you'll find ourselves standing with things rather than at odds with them. The mind alone is capable of controlling the mind. With the mind, we have to restore the mind. With the mind, we have to bring order to the mind. Controlling the mind with the mind involves relentless vigilance. The mind has to be watched relentlessly. And better choices in every situation do not come from conditioning. They come from inner wisdom, which has to be empowered. And this comes down to the heart of controlling the mind. So a single purpose that threads everything, relentless vigilance on our mind that is observed without remission, and the inner strength to act in light of that wisdom will bring order to the mind. Friends, we're going to talk about renunciation on the next two topics. We'll start off a little bit with understanding renunciation and then go a little further into renunciation on the fourth topic. Because it's easy to misunderstand this word called renunciation. Desire or craving is a prompting by the force of habit, and its cessation is liberation or renunciation. The cessation or the break from all of those inner promptings clearly. So we've talked about a need earlier for ongoing vigilance, and this takes resolve and inner strength to be able to see the mind and to be able to act in the light of wisdom as opposed to on the force of inner promptings. If one has a strong urge to know oneself, this can be obviated or this can be overcome. Now, where does this strong desire or urge to know the self comes? From awakened living. We have to clearly see that unawakened living or carrying on status quo is not acceptable, and it both in it I hurt and I cause hurt. When this is seen that we are going nowhere, awakened living becomes natural. In awakened living, there is also the urge to know oneself, because one sees clearly the rise and fall of conditioning along with the danger of acting on it, and one sees the situation and one feels innately or inwardly what needs to be done. So many things can help us as we approach renunciation. The first thing, and we can start with, is good company in all conditions. Now, we have talked about this lightly before. It comes back in at this point. Good company, to keep the best company in every situation, both outwardly and inwardly. When promptings arise inwardly, to be able to substitute them with the positive, with good company, with good inner thoughts. For that, all the things that we read and study and the outer company we keep will come in use. When you keep good outer company, then you learn to keep company with good thoughts and good feelings. And that is a way to renounce or break free of all the old habits and the old modes of thinking. The second is simple living, my friends, simple living. Especially in today's times, life can be complex because things have got a lot faster. Simple living. We're already doing everything for one purpose, for the purpose of seeing the self or seeing our true nature. So in everything, simple living, to bring things down with simplicity, means that the purpose does not extend beyond the action. The purpose and the action melt in the moment. We do things because it needs to be done, because it feels right, and we do things with all of our heart. So the purpose which is in the mind is not ahead of the action which is in the moment or in the present. The future melts into the present. The past does not come in, because we do things because it needs to be done, not because of some ulterior motive tied either to the past or to the future. And there is no future, I'm doing this or for that purpose. So the past and the future melt into the present, into the moment, because it needs to be done. This is the only way in which we can do things wholeheartedly, continually. So this brings it down to a very simple level, action for its own sake. Just think about it, my friends. How many times do we do things because it needs to be done? It is only then that we can let things go, not only after they are done, but while they are being done. The spirit of renunciation takes seed so feverishly in this way that there is no attachment to things, not just when they are complete, but while you're doing them, and at the same time, you're able to do them with intense passion. Usually we think of renunciation with resulting in some kind of cold and clammy feeling, but this is something completely different. To be able to do something with fiery passion, with all the oomph that one has, but without attachment. Matter of fact, you can only do things with passion when there is no attachment. When there is any attachment, the mind is thinking for this purpose or for that purpose. Part of the mind is not in the action, and therefore all of our passion is not in the moment. Understand this point very carefully, my friends. This is what brings it down to simplicity. Why do we call it simple? Because it's one. The simplest number is one. And when all of our actions can melt into the moment, which is one, which is now, it has to be simple. That is a way, tremendous way, to pull the mind off all of its habitual ways of thinking, which is a sort of renunciation inwardly in the psyche. And the last of all, the third point, is to lead an examined life. To look at everything as it comes up, to be able to do things on its own merit, on what needs to be done in the moment. We don't need to carry around all of that baggage in our mind that will help us in each moment if we examine things as they happen. We can let go of all those notions and ideas. See, my friends, these three will weaken the mind greatly, and it'll allow us to see through appearances and notions, and it'll strengthen the urge to know the self even more. So take your mind back to the beginning when we spoke about Rama. And he went out into the world after his education to see things as they were. It is when he saw things as they were, freed of all the notions that he had, even all of his education, he saw things were not quite what they were made out to be. He wasn't anti-things or pro-things. They were just different. And they needed to have some level of inner reconciliation fired up within him. So this seeing things as they are is very important, and the seed of renunciation. If we don't see that the habitual way is frail with all kinds of problems, we're not going to change. When we see that the habitual way is a rocky path and it doesn't deliver the goods or the results or a better way of living and being, then we will find a better way of being, and that is not too far from us, because the inner intelligence is very close and ever ready to do what needs to be done. So this dispassion is actually a changing of gears from the habitual ways, freeing the mind of that, seeing the shortcomings of that, and being able to engage life with a sense of wisdom in the moment, free of the past, free of the future, and thereby giving the mind a new sense of energy and direction by which to travel. When in this bound state or ignorant state, there arises a desire to know the self, then ignorance ceases to be. When we have this auspicious wish, which we have covered before, which Vasishtha calls Shubhicha, a holy wish, an auspicious wish, a good or a noble wish, you can call it an aspiration. When that comes in, the aspiration to go beyond, renunciation has already taken seeds. When the sun of self-knowledge arises, the clouds of ignorance or mental conditioning are at once dispelled. Now, my friends, let us go just a little deeper into renunciation. Renunciation is a very intelligent and necessary pivot for the seeker. You cannot face the light if you don't turn your back on the darkness. This comes down to the heart of it. When you face the light, the shadow is not seen. When you face the light, you turn away from darkness. So unless we are willing to face the light in all situations continually and stay facing the light, renunciation is going to be a tug of war at best. We're going to turn this way without turning away from something like that's even possible. It's not possible. All the struggle in renunciation is a unexamined, wedded to habit. So leading an examined life will allow us not just to break away from habit, but to face the light. Facing the light is breaking away from habit. We just spoke about understanding renunciation earlier. And unless you face this light, unless you face a better way, we're not going to turn away from habit. This is where all the struggle comes in renunciation. We want to break from the past. We want something better, but we're not willing to face something wholeheartedly, to face the new. To face the new, we have to start facing the moment, because the moment is ever new, ever fresh. Can we look at everything, engage everything directly with the inner intelligence rather than with preference, which is based on habit, which is based on conditioning? Can we make that resolve to do this continually and stay in that mode first? Once again, my friends, take your mind back all the way to the beginning when Rama went out on the pilgrimage to see things as they were before he would embark on his duties in life. This is very important. We have to do this continually to be able to make the same resolve to see, to go out of our inner habitual conditioning. Rama's pilgrimage outwardly needs to be our pilgrimage inwardly continually. To be able to go out of our comfort zone every moment. And what is our comfort zone? Our preferences. How we would rather see them. I would rather this happen and this not happen. To go out of that continually is to break free of conditioning. And that is done by engaging what is directly. It's not a very complicated process, but it takes firm and determined resolve. To be able to see things in the moment as they happen and engage them on its own merit because it needs to be done, not for some purpose which puts a portion of the action ahead of it. We have to be completely in the moment because it needs to be done. Not because I've done it this way yesterday either, or because we are used to doing it, or because of something else. That ties it to the past. Because it needs to be done. Wholeheartedly. It is in that one can be wholehearted, put our complete effort in the moment, and break free of both the past and the future, which is hopes and expectations, which is the fabric or the threads of conditioning. Unless we are willing to go out of our habitual comfort zone by dealing with things as they are and as they happen, in the light of wisdom, not in the light of preference, habit will strengthen its grip on us. So we have to first of all start seeing things as they are and as they happen. This comes down to one of the fundamental pivots of renunciation. To see clearly and to see it in the moment. It keeps the mind in the moment and it doesn't allow the mind to get ahead of itself or to go into the corridors of the past or in memory lane. The first ropes of habit are loosened when all the false infatuation, all the hopes, all the desires, all of the other things are broken. And this is the first heart of renunciation, when all the loosening happens, when we start engaging things as they are and seeing what needs to be done on its own merit because it needs to be done, keeping nothing ahead of it and keeping no driving force behind it, weakening the entire fabric of time within the mind. And this stops us from running after things because we like them, before we prefer them, because we take our preference out of action. It's going to come out of all the other things. Dissatisfaction is going to come out of our life. The highs and lows are going to come out of our life. Tremendous good is going to come out of our life. This weakens this entire method, mechanism of attraction and repulsion or rejection, which is based on what in Sanskrit is called raga dvesha, like and dislike. And this is the dividing principle in the mind. So all this that we have talked about, where do we start finally? Vasishtha says very simple. First, abandon the pursuit of pleasure. We're not talking about pleasure, we're talking about the pursuit of pleasure. I do things because of that, because that'll do that, and that will make me feel good. Learn to do things on its own merit, because it needs to be done. Learn to do things wholeheartedly, with all of our heart and with all of our mind and all of our body. And see the delight that comes from being wholehearted. See, my friends, wholeheartedness gathers the rays of the mind. And when the mind is gathered completely and altogether, there is tremendous joy that is felt. When you go on vacation, just think about it. And you're someplace and you say, I'm not going to think about work or nothing else. Your mind is together, all together. And in that, the natural joy of the mind rises. The more it is scattered, the less the joy of the natural joy of the mind and heart rise. So when you abandon the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of pleasure also implies that pleasure is not here. I'm doing this so that pleasure may come. When you take that out of the equation and do things wholeheartedly because it needs to be done and experience the joy that comes from wholeheartedness, we can make the switch. We take out this element of joy or pleasure, which is of the purpose beyond the action, and once again melt it into the action. So this is a very practical way that Vasishtha recommends. And then he says, give up all ideas of division that separate me from the situation and me from others. And this also comes from doing what needs to be done. I stand with the situation and not outside the situation when I don't have my personal purposes. I'm doing this because of me. So I stand outside of things. When we do things for its own sake, on its own merit, we don't stand outside things and we stand with things. There is a largesse or an expansion of personality and the warring that we have of my interests versus other things stops. Tremendous peace and quiescence comes. But again, all this involves letting go of some of the smaller modes of thinking. And then last of all, Vasishtha says something very profound. Go beyond the sense of being and non-being and establish in the non-movement of consciousness, which means to fix the sense of self in one's true sense of self as we go along. And maybe we would talk about this a little bit later in our time together. Now, my friends, aside from being very good advice on practical living or living wisely, this is also a step-by-step approach in meditation and yoga for the destruction of ignorance and transcending the mind. Clinging to our hopes and desires is sorrow. Their abandonment is peace. The hopes and desires keep us in this hoping mode. I hope this happens. I hope that doesn't happen. I expect this will happen. And when it does, there is a sense of joy. When it doesn't, there is a sense of loss and a sense of sort of a down feeling. Why does that need to happen? Why can't we find satisfaction from simply doing our best in each moment? My friends, this will cut out the worrying principle completely. This is at the heart of renunciation, to let go of this entire mechanism of desire. Not just to let go of the object, but to let go of the psychological principle which makes us run after objects and cling to them. Why can't we enjoy things when they come, as they come, without holding on to them at all? See, my friends, have you ever seen a little baby? You give the baby a little piece of chocolate, it enjoys it thoroughly, and then you give it something else. The chocolate is let go, and it enjoys that thoroughly. Why can't we enjoy things as they happen, when they happen, without clinging to them, or all these things that make us run after them and increase our restlessness? Renunciation happens when one faces something better wholeheartedly. First, a better way has to be found, and one has to face a better way or a principle wholeheartedly. As in that, when you face something wholeheartedly, there is an automatic turning away on habit without struggle. Renunciation is thus seen as wisdom in action. Friends, we've talked about quite a few things today. Let us briefly summarize the 4 points that we have talked about. We started off talking about restlessness, and we pushed that restlessness is itself ignorance. Restlessness of the mind is mental conditioning or ignorance in operation. Why does the mind become restless in the first place? There is a resistance to things as they are, and that is also wedded to a preference of things as we would like them to be. So this principle of like and dislike, which we talked about, called raga dvesha in Sanskrit, is at the bottom of this operation. But when the mind is observed without remission, which means continually, we see this restlessness along with seeing what is as it manifests, which is things as they are, and we're able to act in the light of wisdom. This inner restlessness, which is rooted in ignorance, is not only weakened, but quelled. The second thing we talked about is controlling the mind. For this, the mind has to be trained to contemplate or to face things as they are and as they happen. The truth in all things, which is things as they are and as they happen, the truth in all things just as they happen, for it to realize the truth. So we have to first see it on that level. There is a level of truth in appearance, exactly what appears, and there is a level of truth in reality. We won't get to the second part, which will come later in the process of meditation. But the first part is to see things and to deal with things as they are, and to put things on what they are instead of our notions and our preferences. Realization of truth is capable of controlling the mind. For that, we have to put things on the real first. When we put things on the real, the mind no longer goes on the unreal, which is on concepts and habits that it carries within himself. The mind is forced to be on things as they are and not on itself. Conditioning weakens. The mind gets slimmer when it's not feeding on itself. When it looks at reality, there is no diet for the mind. This is an automatic slimming for the mind. Then we spoke about understanding renunciation. Desire or craving is ignorance in action, as we spoke about, and its cessation is liberation. So a clear break from the cessation that we have, or not cessation, the fixation that we have of the mind on itself, on its preferences, is at the heart of renunciation. This, of course, again needs vigilance continually. And renunciation, lastly, the most important principle is you have to face the light. You cannot face the light if you don't turn away from darkness, which is our habits, our preferences, all our isms, all of what you would like to have instead. What is so wrong with things as they are? The only thing that makes it not appealing is our unexamined preference for how we would like them to be. Why can't we enjoy things as they are and let go of the preferences and all the tension that our preferences create? So it is all these ideas that is at the pivot of renunciation. If we let go of all these ideas, we can let go of the outer easily by just engaging better choices. At every moment, the old outer is let go. Just the best choice in every moment. What is best for me right now? What is the best way to do things? Just what is best. And that will take us beyond the grip of habit and closer to our own nature. Renunciation was at the heart of our conversation, dialogue today. The next time, we continue with the important teachings in the third chapter. Friends, thank you for joining me today. To download the video, audio, or PDF of the main points, kindly visit suryadevananda.org. Thank you.